of state segregation, right? It was also about this discrimination in public accommodations. You read Martin Luther King's speeches. He complains about things like, well, a Negro family drives across the country, you can't get a hotel, right? Things like that. Can't go to amusement parks. He mentions that in one of his speeches, the humiliation of it. So that, too, was something that they wanted to correct, and it's part of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Right? And, again, another source on this is John F. Kennedy's speech in 1963 where he calls for a Civil Rights Act. He mentions discrimination in public accommodations as one of the problems as well. So the 64 Civil Rights Act does forbid public accommodations discrimination, and it was challenged by the Heart of Atlanta Motel, which was a motel in Georgia that was near the interstate and near Atlanta, and wanted to engage in this discrimination. And their argument was the Congress doesn't have the authority to do it, and the court said, oh, yes, they do have the authority to do it. So how did they come up with the authority without revisiting the state action doctrine under the commerce power? That's what they did, right? And that's an important step to see that the commerce power is also, has become in the modern period, a source of civil rights power for the federal government, right? And this idea was kind of entertained back in the original civil rights cases, but it wasn't really acted upon. In one of the dissents, Justice Harlan pointed out, well, commerce power, you might be able to forbid this discrimination, but the court didn't really go that direction, but it was resurrected here much later. And this is kind of similar, too. Like, you think about, well, was the civil rights cases of 1883 ever overturned? Not really, you know, at least not in this case. Instead, they found an alternative path to the power. One other point, too, on this that's worth noting before we go on, in terms of discrimination in public accommodations and a lot of civil rights legislation, I tend to find that the public discourse is often kind of confused because people often assume that a civil right is a constitutional right, you know, but they're not necessarily. Some of our civil rights are constitutional rights, but some of our civil rights are statutory rights. In other words, you can't discriminate against people if you're a business owner on the basis of race. Take away the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and you could, right? I mean, it's rooted in federal law. So it's just worth mentioning. I mean, I don't know if I'd want to go into this too much, but Constitution can be understood in two ways. The written document, that's what we usually mean. Sometimes it means, in an older and looser sense, like the whole way of life of the people. You could think about civil rights as being constitutional in that sense. They're so deeply rooted in the legal culture now, nobody would ever think of repealing the 1964 Civil Rights Act. In fact, what people think about mostly is, should we add to the protections or not, right? That's what most jurisdictions do. But, yeah, it is a matter of statutory law rather than technically constitutional law. Last thing here on civil rights, which I think is still an issue today, it's not really a burning issue, but it's an issue that's out there, it'll probably come back once in a while, is affirmative action or racial preferences. Now, there's a connection between Brown and this because Brown versus Board of Education actually leaves the door open to racial preferences of some kind. And the reason is this, go back to Plessy, separate but equal, right? Harlan, in his dissent, says racial categorizations have no place at all in American law. The Constitution does not tolerate them. You could, on a superficial view, view Brown as an embracing of Harlan's dissent, right? After all, Brown goes in a different direction from Plessy. Harlan dissented in Plessy, so doesn't Brown equal affirming Harlan? Well, not quite, right? Because Warren, Earl Warren, in Brown versus Board of Education, is never so extreme or absolute as to say that racial classifications are utterly forbidden. He just says these racial classifications are harmful to black people, therefore they're not in square with the 14th Amendment. Well, it leaves open the possibility that you could have something like affirmative action, like a racial preference program to remedy past discrimination or things like that. And this gets to be a big issue, especially in higher education, where a lot of universities want to have race-conscious affirmative action. And this was challenged about 9 years ago in Grutter versus Bollinger and Gratz versus Bollinger, two cases coming out of Michigan, where Michigan did have these kind of preferences. And basically what the court said in relation to that was, you can do it, but you got to be very careful, I think is their way of summing it up. Basically, Gratz versus Bollinger dealt with, which I mentioned there, it's the companion case, That was a challenge to the affirmative action program in the University of Michigan undergraduate school, right? And think about undergraduate admissions. You're dealing with a lot of people, right? Especially at University of Michigan, maybe tens of thousands of applicants. So how do you manage like a racially conscious affirmative action program? Well, you set up a point system, and you give people points for being of a certain race, right? So X number of points for your ACT score, or SAT score, whatever it is, X number of points for your GPA, X number of points if you're African-American, Native American, or Latino-American, right? And the court said, you know, that looks like a racial quota. It's so close, we consider it to be like a quota, and that's not permissible. Certainly the court's view is that affirmative action raises a constitutional problem, right? It's not necessarily unconstitutional, but it raises a red flag. And to do something like that is too much. That's too much like racial balancing, basically, is what they said. Now, in Grutter versus Bollinger, they dealt with the law school's affirmative action policy. Now, this is different because the law school's affirmative action policy was not as mechanistic, because it didn't have to be. Because when you're dealing with law school admissions, I mean, how many law students do they take in? Maybe 150, 200? So there's a lot more individualized consideration. There's no points for being of any race in the law school admissions policy. It was just a matter of, we consider it to be a plus if you're from one of the traditionally underrepresented groups. And the court said there, well, that you can do, right? As long as it's not too mechanistic again. It's permissible within limits. And the purpose is to be to foster educational diversity. The person on the court, incidentally, who struck out a position against that was Justice Clarence Thomas, who's the African-American on the court. He's kind of a conservative African-American. And he sort of really kind of reiterated Harlan's position and quoted Frederick Douglass and said, you know, the Constitution doesn't permit this kind of thing. Shouldn't have it. You know, it's not consistent with the 14th Amendment. Now, that does leave us in a position where I think there can be more litigation on this, because, first of all, two reasons, one of which is inherent in the case and one of which is external to the case. One is the very nature of the reasoning, as I've presented it, shows you that to say you can do affirmative action within limits raises the question, well, what exactly are the limits, right? Other universities will try different things. I mean, the ones that want to do it and that have state constitutions that permit it are going to try to model their behavior on the University of Michigan, but then there might be others that try to push it a little bit further. There might be some that want to be able to, you know, get it back into undergraduate admissions, but without, you know, the individualized consideration. It would be very costly and time-consuming to do. So that's out there. The other thing, of course, is where's Sandra Day O'Connor now? She retired, right? She's replaced by Samuel Alito, who is more conservative than Sandra Day O'Connor, right? So, I can't predict this, but if a future affirmative action case were to come up, I would kind of expect, I mean, with the court and its current composition, I would expect the court to be a little bit more skeptical about it than it was there, because there were four votes against both versions, right? This was the vote to uphold the affirmative action was 5-4. There were four votes to get rid of it, even in the law school, right? And she's the fifth vote for the ones who saved it. But she was replaced by Alito, so it's not clear, you know, that how that would play out in exactly the same way in the future. Basically, the votes against affirmative action in this case were Scalia, Thomas, Rehnquist, who am I leaving out here, Kennedy, and that was it, right? Now, she's gone, replaced with Alito, that's an extra vote against, right? Roberts is basically, I think, the same as Rehnquist. He would be not much of a change. So Thomas and Scalia are still there. And Kennedy. Kennedy's kind of an interesting character, right? He's liberal on some things, conservative on other things, as we'll see. All right. Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's a good question, and it does relate to an important issue today. And it does go back to the original 14th Amendment, too. Now, I've never heard anybody say they want to repeal the 14th Amendment who's running seriously for the presidency. But what I think they want to do has to do with immigration, right? In other words, if you're the way the 14th Amendment has been interpreted by the Supreme Court says if you're born in the United States, you're a citizen of the United States. So that creates a phenomenon that some people object to, which is that if you enter the country illegally and you yourself are an illegal immigrant, but you have children in the United States, your children are citizens of the United States. And in fact, if you take that theory literally, it would mean if you were here legally vacationing and your child were born, that child would be born a citizen of the United States. So I think it's to get at that they want to modify the 14th Amendment. I think the idea that they want to repeal the 14th Amendment is maybe more the way their enemies characterize it to blame them. And their argument here I can tell you about real quickly. I'll go back to the 14th Amendment for a second. I don't know the correct answer to this, but I can tell you how the two arguments work. The one argument is if you're born in the United States, you're a citizen of the United States, because that seems to be what it says up here, right? Those who argue that that's an incorrect interpretation say they lay emphasis on subject to the jurisdiction thereof, right? All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. So their argument would be there are persons in the United States who are not fully subject to its jurisdiction. It'd be like foreign nationals, people like that. So they think, I mean, in a way, their view is that it's a result of misinterpretation of the 14th Amendment that you get the, you know, infant citizenship issue arising. I don't know. I mean, that's not the kind of thing that's going to go away anytime soon, so that's worth talking about. Let's see, where were we? Oh, yeah, economic rights. Dr. O'Brien was eager for us to talk about progressivism to some extent. Let me talk about the background of this, and I want to talk, too, about the rise and fall of liberty of contract. I think the broad view here is that the progressive movement came along the late 19th century, early 20th century, and it stood for many things, but one of the things they were keen on was the role of the government in reforming the economy to help the conditions of the working class. And a lot of the times, the stuff was framed in terms of rights, you know. And then in response, too, though, the folks on the other side who were opposed to the progressive movement framed their concerns in terms of rights, too. And the early version of this on the Supreme Court was to insist on liberty of contract, right, and to use liberty of contract as a way of pushing back against progressive legislation designed to ameliorate the conditions of the working class. And the classic example of this is in Lochner versus New York. This approach does have a certain shelf life, right? Eventually the court gives up on it, but they did it for a while. The classic case is Lochner versus New York. The so-called Bake Shop Act was the law at stake there. New York passed a law saying bakers can't work more than 10 hours a day and more than 60 hours a week, right? And it was presented as a health measure. Again, it was thought to be unhealthy for the baker and for the consumers of bread, too, because if your baker's unhealthy, then the bread might be unhealthy, right? So we don't want them being overworked. And Lochner was a bake shop owner who was found in violation of the law a couple of times because his bakers were working longer than they were supposed to. And the second time he challenged it and argued that it was outside the scope of the federal government's authority to do something like this. And the court agreed with him. They said, look, there's this liberty of contract, like a freedom of individuals to engage in contracts to work, right? That's economic activity. And this is a violation, an arbitrary violation of liberty of contract. Now, they were careful to try to limit the scope of it to some extent because they didn't go so far as to say that, you know, you can contract to do just anything and the government can't try to regulate it. They recognize what's called the police powers of the states, right, to regulate the economy. The police powers are state powers to regulate in the interest of health, welfare, morality, right, public safety, things like that. And you can understand the Bake Shop Act is falling under that category. So they recognize the legitimacy of those police powers, but they still say, look, there's this liberty of contract. And people who know this history very well, much better than I do, have told me, like historians of the Constitution, that the idea that the Lochner-era court was like this bull in a china shop striking down laws all over the place is not really true. They didn't strike down many laws. But what did happen, and what did prove to be kind of explosive, I think, in the politics of the time, is that a lot of state courts took their cue from this kind of reasoning, right? So then there were a lot of state courts that were basically controlled by conservative jurists who were using this liberty of contract idea to strike down state legislation that was implemented by the progressives. This is part of what made Theodore Roosevelt irate, part of what made Teddy Roosevelt in favor of laws to limit the power of judges. You know, he went around the country making speeches for, judicial recall of judicial decisions to empower the legislature to negate judicial decisions or to remove judges from office if they were too opposed to the will of the people. So that was the contest that was going on at that time. Eventually, the Supreme Court, gave up on this and a lot of other things of a similar nature in the context of the Great Depression. The bookend case on this liberty of contract argument is West Coast Hotel Company versus Parrish, which involves pretty similar issues. The Parrish case involved Washington State's minimum wage law for women, right? And under kind of earlier cases, there were grounds for saying that a minimum wage law is an unconstitutional violation of liberty of contract, right? And the court earlier had said things like that. There's one other thing I want to point out, though. By the way, in Lochner, this is important understanding, I think. The dissenter in that case was Oliver Wendell Holmes, right? And basically what he said, which is helpful to understanding the case, or at least understanding how the case was received, is Holmes has this famous line in his dissent, very typically short dissent, kind of pithy, where Holmes says, "The Constitution does not enact Mr. Herbert Spencer's social statics," right? Herbert Spencer was a social Darwinian, right? A defender of laissez-faire capitalism. So Holmes's point is that he thought liberty of contract was just a concept invented by laissez-faire conservative judges to strike down progressive legislation. He thought it was bogus, right? And eventually that view was kind of vindicated because, like I say, in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish, the court backs away. Now, Charles Evans Hughes, I guess I have a slide on that. There's Lochner. I mentioned the dissent. Get up to West Coast Hotel. It's Charles Evans Hughes, who's the Chief Justice, writes the court's opinion. He doesn't go so far as to say there's no such thing as liberty of contract, but he says something like, he does have a sentence where he says, "The Constitution does not speak of liberty of contract, and any liberty of contract that there is has to be understood in the context of society's needs and the police power." So he definitely tilts the balance back in favor of society's right to use government to regulate the economy. So it's kind of a victory for the progressive movement later on. He also mentions, of course, the Depression. Right? He says new economic conditions have intervened that require us to rethink the extent to which the individuals should be free to just engage in whatever economic activity they can agree to. Let me talk a little bit more here about progressivism, economics, and the role of the state by looking at Franklin Roosevelt. It's really in the New Deal that progressivism comes to full fruition. You know, they have certain, like I said earlier, victories within the states, maybe partial victories if the state courts push back on them. But really at the national level, to get like a kind of more substantial regulation, the economy. It did take a crisis of the Great Depression, and Franklin Roosevelt made the case for this. And he also was kind of careful, Roosevelt, to not just make a case for it that's totally like pragmatic and based upon, well, we've got a depression, so we've got to do new things. He tried to rethink the whole liberal tradition up to the present time and kind of interpret it as being consistent with this. That's what he does in this famous Commonwealth Club campaign speech of 1932. Tries to It's important to the Democratic Party, I think, as an institution, to maintain its links to the founding generation, right? The Democratic Party goes all the way back to Thomas Jefferson. And in some ways, they don't want to just, certainly in Roosevelt's time, just like, act like they're repudiating all that. So what he tries to do in this speech is to show that there is a link to Jefferson, despite the fact, you know, Roosevelt's understanding of federal power is hugely more expansive than Jefferson's, right? And it's basically individual liberty, right, or the status of the individual. He tries to make the link to the founding. He says, in Jefferson's day, in our day, the main consideration is the liberty of the individual. What's changed is the main threat. Right? The main threat to individual liberty at the time of the founding was the state, meaning the government, right? The federal, the nation state. He says that was the environment in which the founders came to political maturity, and that's the kind of stuff they thought about. So the original Constitution is concerned with protecting people against state violations of their rights. But he says nowadays, we've been learning over the last 20 or 30 years that large corporations are really the main threat to individual liberty, right? And they need to be regulated. I mean, this kind of is pretty easy to figure out the chain of reasoning. Who in the society is big enough to restrain the actions of large corporations? Only the federal government, right? And this is what he thinks is legitimate now. He makes a case at the end of his speech for government to take a more active role in regulating competition and ensuring a more fair distribution of wealth. Again, I think kind of a building on the promise of progressivism by Roosevelt. You can see an example of this, too, later on. He was president for a long time, right? He got elected 4 times and served full 3 terms and a little bit of the 4th one. He gives a speech in 1944 on an economic bill of rights. And you can see the flavor or taste the flavor of progressivism in it, right? The right to useful and remunerative jobs in the industries or shops or farms or mines of the nation. So you have a right to employment, on his view. And if you're unemployed, that's not just your problem, it's the government's problem, according to Roosevelt. The right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation. The right of farmers to raise and sell their products at a return which will give him and his family a decent living, right? He goes through and talks about the rest of this stuff. And one point I want to make here is that these are all one of the changes that's occurring here is a shift from negative liberty to positive liberty, right? The old Jeffersonian founding view was to focus on negative liberty, meaning I'm going to protect you from what the government can do to you. It's like protection against coercion. Are you free? You're free if the government's not intruding on your life, right? But positive liberty is, you know, being empowered to do something, actually having the capacity to do it. And you know, there's a trade-off between positive liberty and negative liberty. If you're going to be empowered, it's the government that's going to do it on this progressive view. And in doing that, they're going to intrude to some extent on older negative liberties. But they're willing to do that because they think the positive liberties are more important. And it's worth, or it's necessary to do too, because we have to expand the power of the state to protect us against these corporations that won't let us get a fair shake. And I think this is still a very active, I mentioned this here on the slide, positive versus negative liberty. Still a very active debate, I think, and it's the debate. In some ways, you know, Franklin Roosevelt and the opposition to him still frame our politics today. Democrats, I mean, still stand for the same principles, and the Republicans still stand for the same principles as they've shaken out over the last 60 or 70 years. The policies are different, but the principles are the same. On the Democratic side, it's mainly government should do more to protect the individual against the vagaries of the economy caused by large corporations, right? And the Republicans are more like the vagaries would be better and things would be better off if the government didn't do as much, right? And to focus on negative liberty. Again, that's another way of putting it, that Democrats tend to want to say government should get involved more to positively empower people to achieve the ends that they want to achieve, like in healthcare. Republicans are more likely to say, not that we shouldn't do that at all, but I think their attitude is more, because I think Republicans have made their peace with the New Deal for the most part, you know, and a lot of the welfare state. But their attitude is going to be not that we shouldn't do that at all, but that we already do enough of that, right? We're not going to do any more, right? We've got Medicaid and all this other stuff. We don't need the Health Care Act, right? Or if there are needs that need to be addressed, we'll address them through market-oriented reforms that respect people's negative liberty, right? So that I think, again, I wouldn't want to overdraw the difference because practical political parties always want to compete to win elections, you know, and so like somebody like Dwight Eisenhower, who is a very conservative man and who I think, from based on what I've read about him, would not have supported the New Deal if he had been in charge. Nevertheless, when he became president, he's like, I'm not going to try to overturn the New Deal. That would be a great way to destroy the Republican Party, right? I mean, we accept it now. It's been done. But the basic underlying dispositions are still the same. I think the Republicans tend to be hostile or skeptical of efforts to push positive liberty further than it's already been pushed, and they want to emphasize negative liberty. And you can see all of that, I think, in the argument over the Health Care Act, right? And maybe the smallest microcosm of it is the argument over the individual mandate, right? I mean, the individual mandate is designed to be in the service of the positive liberty of people to be able to have health care, right? There's all kinds of positive liberty rights that are in the health care law. Like, they've been talked about a lot and you know, kind of promoted by the president in favor of the law, that you can't deny coverage to somebody with a pre-existing condition, right? Well, that's like a positive liberty. The old-fashioned kind of negative liberty approach to that question would be like, are you free to have health care? Yes, there's no law against health care. You know, basically, you're free to have it if you can buy it. The progressive view of that is, well, that's not good enough. We've got to positively empower people. That individual mandate is designed in the service, I think, of that positive liberty, because it's designed to bring in the revenues necessary to sustain the health insurance companies in providing all this coverage. But the Republicans contested this thing on the basis of negative liberty, right? Like, how can the government make you purchase something? That's an intrusion on your negative liberty. It's telling you what you've got to do with your own money, right? So, I mean, again, that's a lengthy way, I guess, of saying that I think the basic underlying principles are still the same, that kind of Roosevelt is considered to be such an important president because, in part, we're still arguing about the same kinds of things that he made relevant to national politics. All right, let me shift to right to vote. I think we should say a few things about that. And then I think we'll probably have time to do some stuff on personal liberties, too. So the right to vote, I would emphasize two trends. And here, again, we kind of go back to the Civil War amendments and work our way back up to the present. The two trends, and really this applies to, now that I think about it, not only the right to vote, but really to all the civil rights and liberties that we're talking about. The two trends are nationalization and expansion, right? We get an expansion of civil liberties and civil rights, including the right to vote, meaning the understanding of it's more and more robust. You know, you go back decades or even centuries to the time of the founding, it's kind of a narrow slice of rights that are meant to be protected. Beyond that, government has a lot of discretion to do what it wants to you, right? And more, we think we have more and more rights, and in a way that narrows the sphere of the government's discretion, right? They're not free to deliberate about how to do these things without a court telling them, hey, you can't do that at all, because we have a more robust understanding of rights. And what goes with that, too, is nationalization. It empowers the federal government more and more. And like I said before, too, the federal judiciary especially. Let me just give you a quick overview here of the expansion of the right to vote. Most of this is accomplished through the Constitution, but not all of it. There was, I guess the earliest issue here was like in the early 19th century, property qualifications, right? America's been a democracy of a kind from the beginning, but never like a perfect democracy until maybe if we're satisfied today, right? But, I mean, early on, there were property qualifications in some of the states. They weren't really high property qualifications. I don't think you'd want to call America like an oligarchy for the rich. But there were, you know, relatively mild property qualifications that were designed to at least forbid the very poor from voting. They want to make sure that you're a member of the community, you own some property. Well, those went away, not through any national movement to reform the Constitution, but just on the basis of the states themselves. By the time you get to the 1830s, the states on their own had gotten rid of the property qualifications. So that was done without any kind of national movement. Everything else was done nationally. 1870, we talked about the 15th Amendment already, right? 1913, another amendment to the Constitution, the 17th Amendment. It doesn't exactly deal with the right to vote, but sort of. It provides for the popular election of senators. That's a progressive reform, too. The progressives, in addition to wanting to help the condition of the working classes, they wanted more direct democracy. Well, the original provision for the election of senators was that they'd be elected by the state legislatures. It's a version of indirect democracy, more like republicanism than democracy. So that was done away with, and now today we have direct election of senators. We talked about the women's movement. 1920, we get the 19th Amendment. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. 64, they did away with the poll tax as an impediment to voting. And then, last of all, in this series, 1971, the age limit was lowered, basically. 18 or older, you can vote in the United States for any office. The one that's really kind of a dicey one is the 15th Amendment, because that's the one that was the least enforced at the time it was passed, right? Even the 19th Amendment, think about the right of women to vote. It was controversial before it was done, but not so much after it was done. It'd be a dangerous thing to do. I mean, most men live in a household with a woman, right? So it's like, you know, it would not be easy. It would be family relations. So that didn't happen. But the race issue was a lot. And a lot of states did try to evade the requirements of the 15th Amendment through these various other means, like poll taxes, imposing a tax on people to exercise the right to vote. Like we talked about earlier with the black codes and vagrancy, if you're formerly a slave, you're probably poor, right? You're not going to be able to pay the poll tax. Or imposing literacy tests, right? Asking people to interpret the Constitution or something like that before they're allowed to vote. Now, somebody raised the point earlier, wouldn't that apply to kind of poor, ignorant whites as well? And it would. That's why a lot of these laws included grandfather clauses, right? The grandfather clause is, well, if you can't pay the poll tax, you can't pass the literacy test, but your grandfather was a voter, you can be a voter. Well, that would apply only to white people, right? Not to slaves. So that was the way in which this was done. And then also, the white primary. For a long time, after the Civil War, the South was pretty much what political science would call like a one-party system, right? Republicans were not welcome in the South, other than maybe like in certain localities or like certain cities or places like that that might have had northern sympathies. But for the most part, at the state level, the Democratic Party dominated the politics of all the states of the old Confederacy. The solid South used to be solidly Democratic, right? Today, in national politics, it's a lot more Republican. But to go back 100 years, it was very Democratic, which meant that all the real politics took place in the Democratic Party. Right, a general election between a Democrat and a Republican, that was no contest. The Democrat was going to win. What was interesting was what went on in the Democratic primaries. And because primary elections are not like an election for public office, for a long time, it's just practiced discrimination by having so-called white primaries, right? And there was like a back and forth on this. First, like state law required that only whites can vote in the Democratic primary. Well, that was challenged, and the Supreme Court overturned it. But then Texas is where this was challenged first. The Texas Democratic Party just came back and said, okay, well, then it's just an internal rule of our own that only whites can vote in our primaries, right? And when that was challenged, the court said on the first go-around, well, I guess you can do that because the Democratic Party is a private institution, right? Then they challenged it again later. This is the Smith versus Allwright. And the court said, well, we're changing our interpretation. We consider a political party to be so closely allied with the operations of government that it's a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. So the white primary went away. These other things, poll taxes, literacy tests, basically obliterated by the Voting Rights Act of 1965. That's the other major piece of the civil rights movement of the 1960s in terms of legislation, right? In fact, I guess but like the trifecta basically would be Brown versus Board, the Civil Rights Act of 64, and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which empowered the Justice Department to kind of supervise a lot of these states that had engaged in discrimination. In fact, these portions of the Voting Rights Act are still, again, like to bring this up to the present, the issues aren't as grave, but they're still alive, right? Like, if you see some of these states that have, like, voter ID requirements, and then the Obama administration gives them trouble about that, how can they do that? Through the Voting Rights Act, right? I mean, some of these states are still under the supervision of the Justice Department because of this history of discrimination in the past. So that's not well known, I don't think, but the point I'm making is, not all states are equally under the supervision of the federal government in terms of their voting rights. You know, Minnesota doesn't have the same kind of history as like Mississippi. Nationalization of the right to vote. Yeah, I wanted to make this point, I guess, and this doesn't take very long. The original Constitution left the right to vote pretty much up to the state legislatures. There's no official definition of the franchise or the right to vote in the Constitution. It's purely procedural. It just says Okay, remember this. I should add this. The right to vote doesn't really come into play in the federal constitution for the presidency because of the Electoral College, right? Every state gets to decide how to allocate its electors. Now, it turns out they all do it through popular election. Fair enough, right? Original constitution, the states, in terms of the senators, well, they're elected by the state legislature, so there's no issue with the right to vote there. It really comes into play in regards to the House. And even there, the founders kind of punted. You know, they say, purely procedurally, you have a right to vote for the House of Representatives if you have the right to vote for the lower house of your state legislature. So they tied it to what the states did. It's not a very robust federal definition. It's just over time, all of these amendments bring the right more and more under federal protection because every amendment creates a federal standard, right? That language, again, Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. So we're still kind of in this mixed position. I mean, for many purposes, the right to vote is regulated by the states, but it's constrained by what the amendments require. You know, I think that's the status today. Okay. Any questions or comments on that? Let's cover personal liberties. There's a lot of this too in the things that Dr. O'Brien put in the agenda, and so I want to make sure I don't neglect it. So here we're getting into my personal liberties. I guess I mean the things that pertain to what is today called the right of privacy, right of personal privacy. And one of the things that make these interesting and also controversial is the fact that we're dealing with unenumerated rights in many cases, meaning rights that are not listed in the Constitution. They're rights that come about through judicial interpretation. And so we'll talk about the rise of the modern right of privacy, but I also want to show the roots of it in some of the older jurisprudence. And here's a couple of three cases that are, hold on a second. Yeah, okay. Three cases that illustrate the older roots of this and the limitations of it. Meyer versus Nebraska, Pierce versus Society of Sisters, and Buck versus Bell. So when you think about this personal liberties revolution, maybe, you tend to think back to the 1960s, because that's when people start asserting this right to kind of live according to their own values. I mean, America is much more individualistic in that sense post-1960s than it was prior to the 1960s. There's more of a, I think before the 60s, kind of a, as a social, matter of social history. I mean, people make fun of this, but like think about Leave It to Beaver, right? I mean, that's the right way to live. You know, you've got a mom and a dad and they're married and they're kids, right? That's normal life. And there's kind of, you know, an expectation, a social expectation. That's how people are going to live. Right, and the 60s involves, and the post-60s, this kind of self-assertion of the individual against that model, right? So that's coming up in the 1960s and later, the Cultural Revolution, so to speak. But there are roots of it earlier that, seeds that the court planted that later courts could use to effect this rise of personal liberty and the right of privacy. One of the cases was Meyer versus Nebraska. There was a Nebraska law controlling the teaching of foreign languages to students younger than eighth grade, I think. And basically this arose out of World War I and hostility toward the Germans, right? Especially, they don't want people being taught foreign languages in the schools. We want them to learn English. It's aimed towards assimilation of immigrant populations, right? And again, that has some salience today, too. Some people think English should be the official language of the country. There would be arguments over that as well. And then a follow-up case just a couple of years later, Pierce versus Society of Sisters. Oregon passed a compulsory education act, behind which one of the supporters was the Ku Klux Klan, right? And the gist there was to require people to go to public school, not to go to private school. And the animus there was pretty clearly against the parochial schools of the Catholic Church in Oregon. You know, the Klan was sort of, nativist and anti-Irish Catholic, and they didn't want people going off to those schools getting indoctrinated. And those values wouldn't come to our schools, public schools getting indoctrinated in mainstream American values. Now, in both cases, the court said, you can't do that, right? You can't obliterate private education. The Society of Sisters is obviously like a Roman Catholic order of nuns, right, that ran a school. Now, thinking of religious liberty, the Society of Sisters could have maybe made a claim based upon the Free Exercise Clause, but they didn't do that. they made instead kind of like an earlier, like we talked about, liberty of contract argument. But the court then interpreted it even more broadly as implicating both these cases, the right of people to direct the upbringing of their own children. Right? So we could, that's kind of like the first toehold of this right of privacy or this right of personal liberty. Cases as far back as the 1920s demonstrate a commitment of the Supreme Court, the liberty of individuals to decide how to live their own lives with limits on the state supervision of how they're going to do that. Right? Now, part of what makes this difficult, though, is when I say the court said you can't do that, that's almost not a summary, right? I mean, when you think about it, what I want to say is these are controversial cases theoretically, not practically. Not practically, because most people today, and even then, would say, the government doesn't have any business butting into this kind of stuff, right? They should stay out. The court was right to strike these laws down. Controversial jurisprudentially, though, because ask yourself this question. What right mentioned in the text of the Constitution is violated by this law or that law? And the answer is you can't think of any, right? Because there's no right to be educated in a foreign language or whatever, or in a language other than English. There's no right to send your kids to a parochial school under the Constitution. In both cases, the court vindicated what we call non-textual rights. They said, these are rights that are kind of implicit in our political culture, something like that, but they're not in the text of the Constitution. And the reason that's important going forward, and it raises the same issue over and over again in relation to all these cases, is we're kind of on the horns of a dilemma, because I think almost everybody can think of a case where they would want the court to strike down a law, even though there's no textual right on the basis of which to do it. But on the other hand, when you strike down a law with no textual right, you leave yourself very open to critics of the opinion saying, you're just making that up. That's just made up, judge-made law, right? Just like in Lochner versus New York. There's no liberty of contract, just like there's no liberty of education, right? It's making things up and imposing them on the country because of your own political values. In every case, you could say the same thing that Oliver Wendell Holmes said in his dissent in Lochner. You're using the court as a vehicle of political philosophy. Right, to decide what's just and unjust and what's fitting for a free society. That's basically what they do in these cases. The opinions in these cases are only like 3 pages long. And if I summarize the reasoning in these cases, I mean, think about it like this. This is why they're controversial in a way, well, potentially they are. If a law regulates freedom of speech and the court strikes down that law, first thing they're going to do is point out there's a text in the Constitution. Freedom of speech, First Amendment, those words are there. And then they're going to go into the history and talk about what freedom of speech means, right? In these cases, they're only, like I said, 3 pages long, and the gist of what they say is, this is America, you can't do that. I mean, all they say is that this kind of regulation of education is inconsistent with our free institutions. So, I mean, it sounds good. It makes sense as a citizen, but as a basis for judicial reasoning, it's a little bit thin, right? And so we'll see further controversy about that later on. The last case I'd like to mention here is Buck versus Bell, and it really illustrates the limits of this approach. And the court was willing to recognize certain kinds of personal liberties back in the 1920s, but not every kind. Buck versus Bell is the infamous case coming out of Virginia where, there was a eugenics movement in America about 100 years ago, right, that got laws passed in certain states to provide for compulsory sterilization of the unfit, right? And Carrie Buck was declared to be unfit by the officials of Virginia and was sterilized against her will. And she tried to contest this before the Supreme Court, and the court basically said, no, states can do that. States can compulsory sterilize people. He wrote the court's opinion in this one. And it's kind of an irony about Holmes is that he's kind of known as a civil libertarian because he's in favor later on, and at this time too, of kind of strict protections for freedom of speech. He's kind of like a First Amendment absolutist, like, let's have free speech. But on this, you know, he's in favor of letting the state do this if a majority wants to do it. The kind of famous or infamous line that he has from the opinion, first of all, he says, this is not infamous, but he says, you know, think about war. He says, if the state can ask the best citizens to give up their life for the common good, I don't see why they can't ask the worst citizens, meaning the dumbest ones is what he means, to give up their fertility and to be sterilized. And then the infamous line is, three generations of imbeciles is enough, right? Because, you know, we don't want these people reproducing. That's the mentality, right? The eugenics thinking is, you know, influencing the Supreme Court. So, I mean, that's kind of the other side of this, a certain area that's being protected, but other things that today would be thought kind of highly objectionable, the court said, yeah, you go ahead and do that. The history of that case is very sad, too, because not only based upon the principles I just described, but from what I've read, the standards of due process were not good. In other words, there's evidence to suggest that Carrie Buck was not even mentally incompetent or like whatever you want, like mentally retarded or had deficiencies, like poorly educated, right, because she was poor. And her daughter, you know, they alleged to be like a mental incompetent, but I'm not sure that that was adequately proven. These are just like not well-educated people. So a lot of this stuff went on, and we don't really think about it anymore. There have been books written about it, however, that are kind of interesting. I think there's one called War on the Weak or something like that. But in any case, you know, that's kind of the sort of thing that gets turned around later on. And let me bring us up to the modern period here, the beginnings of the modern period with Griswold versus Connecticut. So here's the origins of the modern right of privacy. But it does have its roots in these earlier cases. So what happened here? We get the right to contraception, which leads to, I mean, hard to see how Buck versus Bell could survive in this present regime, right? States aren't trying to do this, but you believe like right to reproductive freedom would mean a right to use contraceptives if you want to, but also a right not to be sterilized if you don't want to. And that's kind of what this stands for. Griswold was Estelle Griswold. She was a person who worked for Planned Parenthood of Connecticut, right? And she was prosecuted under two Connecticut laws. There was a Connecticut law that prohibited the use of contraception, right? Talk about before the Cultural Revolution and after, right? People forget that America ever was such a country where contraception was considered to be immoral, and the laws prohibited it in certain states. So there was a Connecticut law forbidding the use of contraception, and then there was another law that punished those who advise or abet the violation of the law. So, you know, working for Planned Parenthood, Griswold, with the cooperation of a doctor, gave some kind of public presentation explaining how to use contraception. I think she gave contraceptives away at this thing, and so she got prosecuted. Now, this too, like the earlier one I mentioned, this was somewhat of a collusive case because it's not like Griswold just did this and got prosecuted. I mean, she wanted to be prosecuted, right, because she wanted to challenge the constitutionality of the statute, and she succeeded. She claimed that the law violated the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, which is now being used to vindicate non-textual rights, right? Not just to incorporate the text of the Bill of Rights, but also to protect these other rights that are thought to be fundamental, even though they're not listed in the Constitution. And the court agreed with that line of reasoning. The famous opinion for the court was written by William O. Douglas, who's one of the famous civil libertarians or liberals on the court in the middle part of the 20th century. And he starts out by kind of trying to distance. I mean, Lochner plays a role in all these cases in a way. But Lochner is kind of a byword in constitutional jurisprudence for the court just striking down something it doesn't like, you know, on the basis of their own personal philosophy. That's supposed to be a no-no for the Supreme Court. You're supposed to have some solid constitutional grounding. And so Douglas is aware of this problem, and he wants to say, look, what we're doing here has nothing to do with Lochner, right? We're vindicating a right. And he points out, you know, we have a history of unenumerated rights. I can point back to Meyer versus Nebraska and Pierce versus Society of Sisters, right? That's a right to raise your own children the way you want to. And we think the Bill of Rights and these unenumerated rights cases create a kind of zone of privacy, and he announces this right of marital privacy. There's a right of privacy and especially a right of marital privacy. And he includes some language in there about contraception, like, would we want the police searching the marital bedroom, right? And no, we wouldn't. And he says, this is the right, you know, marriage is an institution older than the Constitution and more sacred than the Constitution, so it's got to be protected. Now that, I could say, is also, like the older cases, not practically controversial, but theoretically controversial, right? And I mean it's not practically controversial because who wants to overturn Griswold and reinstitute laws against contraception? Raise your hand, right? Nobody's going to raise their hand. It's not a popular position among Americans. And in fact, later on, like in the 1980s, when Ronald Reagan nominated Judge Robert Bork to the Supreme Court, Bork said, "That's a nutty law, but there's nothing unconstitutional about it." And that was enough to get him not confirmed, right? I mean, that was part of the ammunition that was used against him. So practically, nobody wants to go back and relitigate that, but theoretically, it is controversial for the same reasons I've already discussed, because there's no textual peg on which to hang your argument. There's no liberty of contraception in the Constitution any more than there's liberty of contract. And that's what makes it look a little bit like Lochner, even though he denies. He says he wants to keep Lochner at arm's length. And I've even seen it in modern times, I mean within like the last 6 years, a liberal scholar of constitutional law give a speech where somebody asked him about Lochner, and he said, you know, pretty thin reasoning. You know, I mean, even he admitted, like, not that he wanted to go back and forbid contraception, but it's like, it's hard. You always open yourself up to these charges of judicial activism or judicial legislation when you defend a right that's not written in the Constitution. So this is a good bridge to the next case. Theoretically controversial but not practically controversial leads us to, I'll skip Black's dissent because basically making the points I just made, Roe v. Wade, right? Abortion. Now we're in the realm of theoretically controversial and practically controversial because it kind of splits the country, right? I mean, some people think this is a great advance in liberty. Other people think it's a terrible thing and should be overturned. This case arose from Texas's abortion statute. It basically just expands the right of privacy from Griswold to include the right to abortion. But there's actually a twofold element to that. Part of it's what I just explained. The other part is it makes the right of privacy a personal right and not just a marital right. You know, like in Griswold, Douglas is careful to say it's a right of marital privacy. Like this contraception right is a right of married couples, right? And then there's a couple of cases that intervene where they expand it and say, well, yeah, even single people would have a right to contraception because that's required under the Equal Protection Clause, right? Can't discriminate between the married and the unmarried. And then, really, in Roe, you get it solidified as a personal right, and it's expanded to include abortion. Whoops. Yeah. Although, Well, it would be, I'm kind of puzzled here because I seem not to have everything that I thought I had. But we're almost to the end anyway, so let me check this out. Anyway, let me leave this slide up. That's a very good question. Where would they get the right to do it? Who said that, by the way, because I was looking down. Okay, very good. It's that old concept I mentioned when we talked about Lochner, the police powers, you know. The states traditionally, now that's not in the Constitution either, and so you could say fair is fair. If you're going to raise the question, where does the right come from? Well, then where does the power come from? Right? But the traditional understanding of American federalism is that this question, where does the power come from, is really a more pertinent question for the federal government than for the state governments because of the 10th Amendment. Right? The old theory is the federal government really needs to trace any of its powers to written text in the Constitution, like Article 1, Section 8, or somewhere else, right? But the states don't have to do that. Amendment 10 just says the power is reserved to the states. It's kind of, as far as American constitutional law goes, the old understanding was, and it's actually still good today, although it's been hemmed in by the Civil Rights Revolution, is that, well, the states have this vast, kind of undefined reservoir of power to legislate the way they think is best for their citizens, and that's called the police powers, right? So health, welfare, safety, morals, right, including morals. So the old states would have said, well, we think contraception is immoral, and just on that, that's enough to forbid it. You know, the same reason they give old state laws to forbid pornography. I mean, there used to be laws. There's still, I mean, probably in most states, there are still laws against adultery, and fornication. Like, fornication is a legal term for sex outside of marriage, right? Those laws aren't enforced, right? In part because the culture has changed so much. And if they were enforced, you could maybe get a case that would invoke a new expansion of the right of privacy. But there really is. That's one of the main tensions, and it keeps showing up over and over again, that's going on in this right of privacy or personal liberty jurisprudence, is the conflict between the state's police powers to protect community morality versus the individual liberty of people to live how they want to. I think the court has kind of progressively allied itself on the side of this personal liberty. Like, the personal liberty has been expanded more and more. Does that make sense? And by the way, this is also, again, to kind of bring it up to the present day, this is why the argument plays out the way it does over the Affordable Care Act, right? Like, is Mitt Romney totally inconsistent by saying, as he did before the Supreme Court decided this, right, I think, you know, I signed Romney Care, and I think that was a good thing, but I think the individual mandate in the Obamacare is unconstitutional, right? Well, not necessarily. Who knows what his political calculations are, but as a theoretical matter, you can say something like that because what's the justification for the state of Massachusetts having an individual mandate? The police power, right? I mean, like, hardly anybody would deny that I know, even among, like, hardcore conservative jurisprudence people, would deny that a state can make you do that, right? Because the state's powers are broad and undefined. It becomes a problem in relation to the federal government because you have to ask yourself, what's the scope of the commerce power? One simple way to put this is the traditional understanding is the states have a police power, but the federal government does not have a police power. The federal government doesn't have a power to just do anything for the sake of what they regard to be good, moral welfare, right? It has to be attached to some specific provision of the Constitution. So that would be where they would come up with this idea about a right to forbid contraception in the first place. Does that make sense? Okay. Let me talk a little bit about Roe, then. I accidentally got out of the other view, but that's probably big enough to look at, isn't it? We're running out of time, aren't we, Bill? Four-ish. Okay. So let me finish this, and I'll bring this one up to date, and then I think that'd be a good place to stop with the personal liberties. In Roe, and let me try to explain why I think it remained controversial. The court kind of tried to present itself as staking out a middle position, but I think part of the country didn't buy that, right? The kind of anti-abortion movement or the pro-life movement. The court has to deal with Texas abortion statute, right? And on the one hand, and the claim of Roe that it's a violation of her personal liberty. And the court basically says there's two extremes here. One is Roe, who says she has an absolute right to abortion, no questions asked. And then the state of Texas, which says we have a right to regulate this, no questions asked by the Supreme Court, right? And they say, well, it's really in between. There is a right to abortion, but it's not an absolute right. States can do things to limit abortion. They just can't forbid it outright. You know, and they set up this trimester scheme where it's like states can never forbid abortion in the first trimester. They can regulate it for the health of the woman in the second trimester and later, and they can regulate it for the health of the woman and the potential life of the fetus in the third trimester and forward. So it looks like the state has a certain liberty to get in there and regulate abortion. However, here's where the people who really dislike Roe have a complaint, right? They will say Roe creates a regime in America of abortion on demand, meaning you can get an abortion if you want one, period, right? Now, that's not really true based upon what the court said, because they set up the trimester scheme, right? And they say in the third trimester, you could regulate to protect the potential life of the fetus. But there's this language. Here's what the people opposed to it say, and what keeps it controversial, I think. The language in Roe that says the state can even forbid abortion in the third trimester, but not if it's necessary for the health of the mother. And the health of the mother includes psychological health, right? And so the people who dislike Roe think that that leaves the door open whereby you pretty much can get an abortion. Like, all you have to do is go around to enough doctors and tell them, this is so damaging to me psychologically that you're going to find one, right? And in fact, in many states, I mean, you wouldn't even have to look that hard because there'd be some doctor who specializes in abortions who's just going to consult with you briefly and is going to do it, right? So I think that's part of what keeps that controversial. Then what's some of the other fruit of Roe versus Wade? I think the whole debate today about gay rights and gay marriage flows from this too. The last case I'll talk about is Lawrence versus Texas. I don't have a slide for it. Although I think you have a slide for it in what I sent you. Somehow it's left off of this one that I have here. But in the Lawrence case, the court struck down another Texas statute, one that prohibited basically homosexual acts. Now, this would be the same thing as with contraception, right? The old police power understanding that we can forbid the things that we find to be immoral. There had been a similar law in Georgia in the 1980s that was challenged by the Supreme Court, and the court said, law is perfectly acceptable, right? If privacy doesn't stand for anything other than the right to have an abortion and the right to have contraception, to control your reproduction, right? But homosexual sex is not really reproductive, right, by its own nature, so it's not even an issue. But in the Lawrence case, which was 2003, so it's 9 years ago, the court said, no, you can't have laws like that anymore. So that's another expansion of the civil liberties, right? It's basically, I mean, you could look at it this way. Let me put it both like in popular language and jurisprudential language. The Supreme Court kind of, through Griswold, I think, affected constitutionally the sexual revolution for heterosexuals, right, in the 1960s, early 1970s, and probably in Roe, too, right? Because you can use abortion as like a backup form of birth control or something, right? But then through the 70s and 80s, they were given some opportunities to expand that to like a right that would include homosexuals, but they didn't do it. But then in 2003, they agreed to do it, right? Basically by saying, I mean, it's an expansion of the people who are covered. The jurisprudential changes, pre-Lawrence, they would have said, yeah, the right of privacy is a right to not reproduce if you don't want to. But it's not a right to just engage in whatever sexual activity you want to. But from Lawrence forward, they're saying, well, it is a right of like sexual liberty or right of intimacy, right, is how they put it. So it does include homosexual acts, right? And that leads into, I mean, and again, that I would put in the category of jurisprudentially controversial because, again, there's no right that you can there's no textual right, I'm sorry, in the Constitution that you can use, but not really that practically controversial. Like even really conservative religious people, I don't think, are really care that they're not hugely in favor of like prosecuting people for homosexuality, right? I mean, that's what's at issue in Lawrence. But where it is controversial is how does it play into gay marriage, right? And that's the one that we're still living out right now, I think. In Lawrence versus Texas, Justice Kennedy, and this is kind of like my last word on this, Justice Kennedy wrote the court's opinion. Justice Scalia wrote the dissenting opinion. And Kennedy is very careful in that opinion to say, look, all we're saying is you can't use the power of the state to punish people for engaging in homosexual activity. He says this has nothing to do with gay marriage one way or the other. He doesn't use the term gay marriage, but he says this has nothing to do with what, you know, unions are entitled to government recognition or something like that. And then in his dissent, Scalia says, I know Kennedy's telling you that this has nothing to do with gay marriage, but don't believe him because it does. It will lead to gay marriage, Scalia says. And the jury's still out on that. The Supreme Court hasn't had anything to say about gay marriage, right? But some state courts have. The state courts that have used reasoning similar to what's in Lawrence versus Texas. So they've kind of glommed on to Kennedy's reasoning and tried to apply it in this area. But Kennedy himself is not responsible for that. So it's still, I guess in 5 or 10 years, we'll probably know how this will have played out. But it's still kind of incubating right now, I think. And there are courts coming up through the federal system that deal with this. Let me say one more sentence or two. The part that we don't have time to get to had to do with like freedom of speech, but that can be, you guys can look at the slides and you can see that it's kind of the same trend is going on, an expansion of what freedom of speech understands, right? And that's part of the, I think, the trajectory of American civil liberties over the course of the 20th century. Early 20th century, the Supreme Court would not get involved that much to protect your freedom of speech. Nowadays, they do it all the time, and it's understood to be much more comprehensive than it was earlier on. All right, I think maybe we should wrap it up then. All right, thanks.
it's going to be. And then I started to think about there's no way to get food, there's no way. Then the hotel had no power, and I thought, oh God, so it was wild. But anyway, I appreciate all of you for being so flexible and able to get this in. The only other option, if we couldn't figure out a way to get it in before the start of school, was to do a couple of weekends and do it that way. And we could have done that, but because since it launches the year, until we actually had our meeting, we couldn't institute the stipends, for one thing. I couldn't, you know, until you actually came here and signed the papers, we couldn't do that. So anyway, we're in for, I hope it's an interesting week. We're going to be live, and I have a handheld, so as you have questions or anything, let me know, and we'll get it on so everybody can hear. This first day is pretty much going over where we are and where we're going and how we're going to adjust and what's going to happen and all of that. As you look through the agenda, which is in your packet, we'll be looking at the agenda specifically in a moment. You'll notice that I hope that I built in a lot of time for you, free time. One of the things that we're going to do today is create teams. Now, obviously, we don't have all that many folks, and I'll explain what we're going to do. But we're going to be creating teams, and I'm going to be giving you some time today, this afternoon. So if you check your agenda, you'll notice that after we have our a break at 3 o'clock, 3:15 this afternoon, we don't do anything until dinner, and then we're going to have dinner here tonight. And then Bob Bliss will be here to present tonight and tomorrow morning. I had dinner with him last night. He drove in yesterday from St. Louis. And he's staying at the... When he found out he could sleep in this morning, he couldn't believe that. I said, oh, yeah. He thought he was going to be up right out of the gate. I told him that was tomorrow morning. But and then we have Bob will finish tomorrow morning. Then we will have Abe Lilly from the library, who's going to be talking about access from a distance to the holdings and Rotunda, and many of you probably know all that, but he's going to do it. We have the computer labs here. Everything's available to us this week. And then after lunch tomorrow, Carson Holloway is coming in from Omaha, and he'll be here Tuesday afternoon, and then we leave. Late, 4:00, 4:30 on Tuesday afternoon. And we didn't schedule anything on Wednesday, and that gives you a chance to get home. And I realized this morning that scheduling the start time when you're coming from home at 8:30 is not really fair. Some of you come a pretty good distance. And the same thing will be true Thursday, and it will be true next Monday. So what that means is we'll kind of plan to start at 9:00. We'll have the food ready at 8:30, but we'll plan to start at 9:00 because it takes you a while to get here. I know that. You'll have some couple hours this afternoon to get together with a teammate and also for those that are staying, you can register for the sleep in. It's right across the road here. They register this afternoon at 3:00, and it's pretty nice. I think Bob stayed there last night. It's pretty nice. It's relatively new. It's one of the newer hotels here in Beckley, and it's not dirtied up too bad yet, I don't think. So anyway, so we have that. And what I want to do is kind of touch on some details and information. But I want you to feel free to ask questions and interact. A lot of this is just stuff that came. You know, this whole concept has come out of my head, and it's not worked out. And some of the stuff that comes out of my head of late scares me. So help me, you know. And what I mean is this needs to work for you. There are a couple of things that I wanted to touch on with you early on. There are a couple of things that are happening that carry a lot of potential, and I don't know how it's all going to shake out. But it seems like there's going to be a number of opportunities for not for me necessarily, but for you. And so what I'm trying to do is use the opportunity to finish this grant as a way to phase into something that might ultimately be even bigger and produce more opportunities for you. It would be totally a choice thing. I mean, if you want to do it, the opportunity will be there. And I'll share that with you in a moment. I just wanted to touch on the schedule. We didn't tell the folks doing, we have different people that are going to cater each day. We're trying to build a little bit of variety into the schedule. So the same people, it's not going to be the same food every day. And we have Pasquale's at least once. I don't want to blow Margaret's cover, but I actually think we're having hot wings one day as well. But anyway. And then we're scheduled on Thursday evening to go to McBee's, which is the Irish pub uptown in Beckley. And they have a trolley. And they're going to pick us up here in the trolley and take us to McBee's. And I don't know if any of you have been there. Some of you may have been there. But it's a pretty nice restaurant. For Beckley, it's pretty nice. And they know we're coming. And then they'll bring us back here. And we'll be firing up the technology here for a presentation by Jeremy Suri. Jeremy is, and I've never met him. He's at the University of Texas in Austin. He's pretty has made some pretty heavy tracks, basically, in American foreign policy. He was at Wisconsin for a number of years. He's a good friend of John Kaminsky's. That's how I got the... I asked John who he thought that would be really good in foreign policy, and he came right back and said, there's nobody better in the whole country than Jeremy Suri. And he was at Wisconsin for 10 years. And John said, one of the highlights he had when he went in the office in the morning was having coffee with Jeremy. And Jeremy's a young guy, a relatively young guy. Anybody that moves is young to me, but he's, I don't know what he is. I'm guessing he's probably maybe 40, something like that, early 40s, something. For example, he told me when I rescheduled, the only day that I couldn't schedule him was Thursday because it's his anniversary and he and his wife are taking a day-long bike ride. And I thought, God, I was going to do that too, you know. But anyway, actually, it's a lot easier for me to get a beer and watch him do the bike ride. But anyway, but he'll be presenting on Friday, and this is one that we haven't tried before. So that's a little bit intimidating as Friday comes. But we got his address and his Skype address, and we think everything. We're going to kind of bring him in on the screen here. And I'll be giving you in the spring. When we start the class on foreign policy, I'll be giving you copies of his book. I already bought them. He's written a book on nation building, which has got some pretty great reviews. And we'll be doing that. There's a lot of neat stuff that's going on. One of the things we'll be giving you volunteer the mini book during this time, probably Thursday, maybe. And the DBQ folks, Phil Roden and Chip Brady, are, besides, as you know, they have many books in DBQ books in U.S. history and in world history. They're also coming out with a volume, an edition, on citizenship. And that, as we'll talk about in a minute, that is going to be a major focus of where we go, I think. And so I've been in touch with Chip Brady, and I told him that we were going to purchase 25 copies of the citizenship minicube book when it's available, and actually be about 40 copies. because not only are we going to give copies for each of you, but we're going to put copies in all the local libraries as well. And he said that should be ready around right after Labor Day. So we'll be giving you copies of that as well. And that is pretty appropriate in light of where we're going. So stop me at any time. If you look at the packet that you've got, the agenda, and maybe, you know, some of you probably have, and I'm not going to insult your intelligence by reading what's in here to you. But what I put in here in item one is I'm trying to basically ground us and explain where we are and where we're going. The federal government, as you know, can't agree on anything. Congress can't do anything. And everybody's waiting for the election, and after the election they won't do anything either. So, probably. So, anyway, they did not put funding in for the American History Grant for the Teaching American History program for the fourth and fifth years. They are making it available to get new grants, but they folded them in with grants in a number of other areas, sociology, psychology, political science, and several others. And so they've appropriated a pot of money, and history would be able to apply for those, but they would be in competition with other disciplines besides history. But what they did is they did not follow through on the fourth and fifth year funding for five-year programs that they had funded, which was a number of them. There were about 40 of them. We were one of about 40, I think, that was supposed to be a five-year program. So basically, by doing that, Congress saved about $30 million because most of the five-year, I mean, it's unbelievable. I can't believe it. But we were funded, this grant was funded for $1.6 million. $1 million for the first 3 years and two-thirds of $1 million for the last two. So if most of the grants, the five-year grants were the same as ours, then I'm guessing that probably a half to two-thirds of $1 million per grant, and there were about 40 five-year grants. So I'm figuring it's probably about $30 to $40 million that Congress didn't appropriate. So it's not just us, is what I'm saying. But what that means is that what we tried to do, and I've banged Keith all over the place. This is tough because I just get down and say, I got an idea, will you listen, and you know, and all this stuff. And he just patiently sits there and listens, and then I leave, and he basically asks for forgiveness. Or for me, maybe, I don't know. But anyway, what we had to do was to reconfigure what was planned in the grant with the idea that it would end after 3 years and look like at the end of it that it was a planned enterprise. That instead of being a 5-year plan, what that meant was that we had a year devoted to human rights and civil liberties. And we had a year devoted to foreign policy. And the last item we had was on leadership. And we got 1 year to do that. Well, obviously, there's no way we could do that. So what we're trying to do is combine them all. So what we're doing here in this very short time that we have together, the 5 days that we'll be together, we're going to have the first portion of it on rights and liberties, human rights and civil liberties, and then beginning Thursday night and Friday morning with Jeremy Surrey, we're going to do some foreign policy. And then on Monday, next Monday, we'll be asking you to break into teams and to do some module development around citizenship, and I'll get into that in detail in a minute. And kind of share what you've got with everybody else on Monday, and a few other things that we'll be doing, and that will be it. And then we'll be continuing to do our chat sessions. We want to basically try to use that to communicate with you. I am planning to ask if we can get together, because theoretically, you know, our grant ends June 30th, this coming June 30th. That's when everything, theoretically, all the money spent and what's not spent goes back and all that other stuff. I am thinking that next summer, early on, we might be able to get together one more time, but it won't be a presentation type togetherness. It'll be to kind of look at modules and things, and kind of a wrap-up session one final time, because I think we'll probably have the funds available to do that. And then what we don't spend, we'll send back to the federal government. Lord knows they can use it. So that's where we are. So under on your packet here where it says item one, that's basically what we've done. What I tried to suggest also here was that obviously we've lost a lot of people. And there are a number of reasons for that. I'm probably one, major one. I don't know. I want to be open here, even though we're broadcasting, and I don't want to, you know, hang out all of our laundry for the world to see necessarily, but I do want to be very honest and ask for your honesty and input as well. There are a number of reasons. And I'm going to have to basically explain those as to why I think for one reason. I mean, there are several. One reason is that we were never able to target, even though we said we would in the grant, the schools and teachers that we wanted to target. The plan was that the No Child Left Behind legislation was identifying specific schools in West Virginia that were underperforming. And we wanted to make direct access to the people that teach history in some of those schools. And we had on staff the person to do it. And when we started our grant the very first year, that particular person was out due to family illness for almost the entire first year of our grant. What that meant was that all we could do to recruit teachers was to advertise the grant and tell what we had, and basically, and I don't mean this negatively, but to take what we got. You know, I mean, just the people who agreed to work with us, we took. And we had enough. But the point was there were a lot of, under the grant, we had told the federal government we would target certain schools. And we didn't have the person to do that, to help us with that. And part of the reason was we were going to go, the plan was we were going to the school principals. We went to the superintendents. We could do that. But that's as far as I could get. That's as far down as I could get. And we got letters of support from all the superintendents to communicate with the principals in each individual school and talk to individual teachers and try to persuade them to participate and all of that. But because we didn't have access to the staff person, we weren't able to make contact with the principals, which meant we weren't able to get the schools involved in the program. And the idea was that if the school knew all about the program, what we were trying to do, then the school would go to the teachers with us and say to that, to the teacher, basically, we're prepared to cut to do everything we can do to support you while you do this because we feel that it's going to benefit our school. And so suddenly, it wouldn't be just an agreement to participate between you and me. It would involve the school and the principal and everything else. We never got that. So that meant that while some of the teachers that we've had and that we do have are from those schools, it's by accident more than anything else. But there are an awful lot of schools out there we never reached. There are counties in this, for example, we never got anybody. You know, Summers County, for example. We don't have anybody from the, and it's right here. You know, and so that's one frustration. For me, that's been one of the issues of frustration. And there are others. But that's the downside. The upside is the technology stuff. No way when I wrote the grant that I have any idea that we were going to be doing what we ended up doing. And this has all been flying by the seat of our pants. Literally, I never did any of this stuff before. And but because what we ended up doing is building up a clientele outside that got interested in the programs, interested in the presentations, interested in the chats. And we actually, in one chat that we had one Sunday afternoon, had more than 2,500 people tuned in from everywhere. And we were getting we've gotten emails from students at Princeton University, from some guy in Great Britain, from somebody else in Australia, and what they're doing is they're downloading these things on iPods and watching them later, and then they watch it and they react and they send an email to Bob. So Bob shares these emails with me, and we got one email, one absolutely stupendous email, from a PhD in archaeology in New Mexico. And he talked about what we're doing and the chats and the reviews of literature and the guests we've had and all this stuff. And said, I don't know, he said, I can't believe this is, first of all, I can't believe this is coming out of West Virginia. You know, that's the first thing. But it's a positive thing. And the fact that I can't believe that this kind of thing is happening in West Virginia. And then this little girl from that's a student at Princeton University said, you know, this is unbelievable. I've got people in my classes and instructors and teaching assistants and everything else that I'm telling them about this. They can't believe it. Now, she did not tune in because of the program. She was tuned into his network anyway. She used to listen to his radio program, and when that came on, Bob knew her, and knew who she was. He had talked to her. She had called into his program before. But then she got into the chats and talked about things we were doing and things that she's studying and she's been sharing with instructors, that many of the things they're doing, we're doing on the air, you know, on the radio. You know, and so the point is, we have a clientele that has emerged that's beyond and outside what anything that we had intended to do. Now, that doesn't mean that we suddenly play to them and ignore you, obviously, because you are the focus of this whole program. But at the same time, it's a way to offset, you know, we lost a lot of teachers, but on the other hand, we did such and such. One of the other issues, and I'm going to try to be delicate here for a number of reasons, but... Sure, do it. Let me give you this.
Well, I think that one thing that we want to do is one thing I try to do is bring in people to
Yeah, everybody but him.
About what you want to talk about, because basically that's what we do with our guests. I told Michael Curry, I said, you come on the radio program, we'll talk about what you want to talk about. And he wanted to talk about William Lloyd Garrison. And so... if you want to talk about some particular issue in terms of teaching history or some particular content, we'd love to have you on. I mean, Brian, you're doing things with the Holocaust Museum. We'd love to maybe have something about that at some point. So anything like that would, I think, benefit not just this community, but teachers around the country. And so think about being guests on our radio program, okay? It's not that hard, right? In fact, we've never had trouble filling 2 hours, have we?
No. Never.
We've had trouble stopping, but we've never had trouble filling up.
I was told one time I had diarrhea of the mouth.
Is that your wife? Is that?
No.
Okay. All right. So just give that some thought.
Well, I'm going to pick up on that a little bit more because that's kind of mentioned in here in a way, but I didn't put it in there in straight out terms because I didn't want you to feel like I was setting you up for anything. But this fits in exactly to what Keith just said. This session we're doing Friday with Jeremy Surrey on Skype, we can Skype with you. You know, if you have a laptop or a TV with a camera in it, we can have direct interaction on video. Now, of course, the problem is there are a lot of areas in West Virginia that don't have access, that don't have the technology to make this stuff work. But there are some areas that do. And the point is we can do that. And one of the things that we're thinking down the road is the idea that we can have you on without you leave. I mean, you could do it from your school or whatever. You can do it from home, which is what I think. I don't know whether Surrey's going to be in his office or whether he's going to be at home when he's on Friday. So this is an opportunity for us to try out one new thing that we'll be able to use this year in the chats and everything else. I've been in communication regularly with John Kaminsky. John is more than willing to come on Skype. Stanley Cutler is. I emailed him because what we're doing this fall is on rights and civil liberties in the Supreme Court and the Constitution. And I asked him if he'd be on, and he said, you know, that he would be glad to, as long as he knew what the, and in other words, he knew where we were going and what we were going to talk about. It wouldn't be just a rap session. And we can do that with a lot of people, but we can also do that with you and have you on. And the other thing we can do is in terms of interaction on the chats with Skype, and we literally can see each other, you know, by talking back and forth, and everybody else can participate in it, can witness it, can hear it, see it, etc. So we're anticipating some really neat stuff that's going to happen over this year. But I've never done any of it, so it's all new to me. But what the heck, we got the technology, we got the money, we might as well see what we can do. And so that fit right in with this. The reason for the reason for the chats is because I just don't like the idea. Everything I read about online instruction, that people who are in online courses are just kind of free-floating out there. Nobody knows they're there. They don't know anybody's there. They get the feeling that nobody even knows I'm here, knows who I am, cares about me or anything else. And so by doing these chat sessions and these interactions, it allows us occasionally to come back together and talk. Now, most of the talk, very honestly, so far has been between Keith and me. I know that. But the point is we do have the communication. We do get, you know, Margaret's been running in with emails. We basically say we got an email from somebody about such and such. And we want to basically expand the interactive part as much as we can. So the reality is the technology has created additional challenges but additional opportunities as well, not only for the program and for us, but for the fact that it has enabled us to get what we're doing out beyond the four walls here. And I think that's significant. And that goes into something else, and this is a little bit more specific. And I've got this under item 2 on page 2 of your agenda. One of the dreams that I had very early on in the process was to basically find a way to enhance people's understanding of the Constitution of the United States. I mean, not only am I interested in the founding, but one of the things that I wanted was the communication, the outreach aspect. And so many of you know, I've mentioned this before, that 10 years ago I was on a daily live talk radio program from here, from Beckley. That's where I met Bob Kincaid. He did the evening program there, and I did the afternoon program. I was on from 3 to 5, and Bob was on at night. And that's where I got to know him. And I did that for better than 5 years. And the most surprising thing to me was that I didn't even think about the fact that I could even do it, but I did it. And So the fact is, I began to realize by taking calls on the radio and talking to people that unlike teaching, and this is where we live, you know, I know, and that's why I'm very, I want to be very precise here. One of the things I realized by listening to people calling in on the radio and interacting with me is that that kind of thing doesn't happen usually in most classrooms. And what I mean is, and I don't, I'll try to be sensitive here. What I mean is that as long as there's grades involved, then there are a number of other things that affect who talks, who doesn't, what they say, what they won't say. In other words, it's a very, very artificial communication for the most part. And I kind of guessed that all the years I was teaching. And you probably have noticed that too. Your interaction comes from the same seven or eight, usually one or two people in the class, and everybody else just kind of sits there, which is what the DBQ thing is good about, because it gets everybody, you know, that thrash out session is superb because everybody's in it. But on the radio, people call in and they say, this is Top Limb from Houston or something. You know, I mean, you have no idea who you're talking to. You don't know them. They don't know you. If they give you a name, it's an artificial name. Sometimes they give you the first name. This is Mike. This is Jim or whatever. Sometimes that's a phony. So you don't really know who, most of the time, who you're talking to. And you don't have a grade. They can shut you off at any time. So what I found is the interaction is a lot more honest. And sometimes a lot more painful, very honestly. But it's a lot more honest and you learn more. That's the first thing. The other thing I learned doing that was that I always thought I was a good listener. But I learned that I wasn't. And I learned, and I've seen this more and more since I realized this. Educators tend to be teaching all the time, which means we tend to be pontificating all the time. And so what I found is that a lot of times when somebody was, if a student was saying something to me, I was listening. But at the same time, I was planning my response. You know what I mean? So therefore, my response might have been in a direct response to the comment or the question, but not necessarily. And a lot of times, the communication was like this, because I'm trying to do one thing and the person's trying to tell me something else. On the radio, you can't do that because there's nothing but what they say. So you have to listen. And I find myself listening more than I ever listened before. And I began to realize, geez, I've been a lousy listener. I've been screwing students for years. You know, I mean, asking them to talk to me, and then they talk to me, and I really don't listen. You know, I listen, but I don't listen. You know what I'm saying? And you can hear this all the time. If you listen to talk shows, you can hear it all the time. Nobody ever hears anything. They just talk past each other. That's part of the problem in this country. So anyway, that's one of the other advantages I noticed. So based on those experiences, I began to think to myself, if I could translate the academic part of what I do with that, with the communication piece, if we could find a way to educate the general public on the Constitution, and not just the Constitution, the parts of it and the language, but the application of it in today's world, the issue of rights and Supreme Court cases and elections and candidates and money in campaigns and large corporations buying elections with super PACs and the issue of rights and liberties and speech and all of these other things. Not in a classroom setting where there are grades involved, but just get people talking, because one of the things that has bothered me very, very much, as I'm sure it bothers many of you, is the fact that there's so much going on out there today where people are saying definitive statements about historical things that are absolutely wrong. and they don't care. It doesn't matter whether they're wrong. They lie. I mean, there's a thing going on right now where Harry Reid, Speaker, you know, President of the Senate, Harry Reid, basically said that somebody told him Romney hadn't paid taxes for 10 years. He said that on the floor of the Senate. Well, then after they had a recess, the media jumped all over that. And they went up and stuck microphones in his face and said, tell us, who said that? He said it was somebody that worked at Bain with Mitt Romney and blah, 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 blah. And the next day, Reid is not saying, somebody told me that he didn't pay taxes for 10 years. He's saying on the evening news, Mitt Romney didn't pay taxes for 10 years. He doesn't know that. I mean, you know, the fact that Romney won't release his taxes suggests that there's something he's trying to hide, but we don't know that that's it, you know. But the point I'm trying to make is it's crazy out there. And people don't know what really is going on. And so there needs to be a general education process for the community at large that doesn't involve red pens and grades and comments on papers and midterms and all that other stuff, because that's artificial. It's not. We've got to basically educate people so that they know what's going on, and they know how to recognize falsity from truth. They know how to recognize people who, you know, if somebody has an agenda, they need to be able to see that. And if we can do that. So anyway, that's what I thought. That was where I'm coming from. So I thought once we began to see these chats and the numbers of people that were listening in to our presentations and here in the summer academies and on the chat sessions and things, we can do that. So I began to get this idea about an outreach program that would basically be focused around the Constitution of the United States. And in looking at the CSOs, and especially the new core standards that are being adopted by almost every state now, one of the things I began to see is that citizenship is becoming more and more, for years it was, several years ago, many years ago, citizenship was a regular part of the curriculum. It became a joke. Most of the people that were hired to teach civics education and citizenship were football coaches and basketball coaches and various other things that didn't know anything, and they, you know, and it became a joke. And so basically, what it became is everybody in this classroom has to visit a volunteer agency once, so to get a B in the class, or you need to, you know, to get an A, you need to visit two volunteer agencies, and if you can prove to me that you did, you get the A. It became almost nothing. It became a joke. So gradually, citizenship disappeared from the curriculum of most of our public education. And again, as the emphasis has been placed more and more on science and math and reading, history and everything else has been pushed into the background or pushed off the table a little bit in the interest of reading and math and science. And of course, citizenship was one of the first things to go. I think that probably went even before the arts, you know, before art and music and those kinds of things went. And part of the reason was because it did become, I mean, it was, I can remember it. I taught it. I can remember it was a joke. My very first teaching experience was in a middle school. At that time, they called it junior high school in Boston. And it was actually 1969. And it was a black school in inner city Boston. And I was teaching a course in civic education. And there was no book. And I said, what do I do? And they said, whatever you want. And I said, are there any audiovisual materials? And I went in and to the library, and they gave me a film strip. It used to be one of those things you crank through the thing. Gave me a film strip. And I said, where's the audio? And they say, the record broke. And I said, what does that mean? And they said, well, this is a great opportunity for you because you can run the film strip and you can make up your own script. And I thought, but my God, I mean, that's a joke. What a waste of time. Yeah, it's stress for me and it's a waste of time for them. But anyway, that was part. I mean, that was just par for the course in terms of citizenship education. So I began to think, well, maybe what we could do. We got Rotunda through the grant. We started to build up the resources in the library and in the local libraries, and the connections between the local libraries and contact. The Mountain Library Network now includes all the libraries in West Virginia, all the public libraries in West Virginia. And the interaction, the moving of books and resources back and forth is a lot more efficient than it was before. And interestingly enough, at least in this part of West Virginia, Concord's library has become much more an integral part of the whole library process. And because of that, we've been able to really build up the early American, the Founders Collection, and the Constitution Collection at Concord, especially with access to Rotunda and all the sources that are there. So I got this idea. Wouldn't it be great if we could set up some sort of a center for the study of the Constitution? Hopefully name it after Senator Burr. There's nobody that deserves it more. His whole life was spent, focusing, the last part of his life at least, on the Constitution and the importance of the Constitution. People need to read it and know it, appreciate it, and all that. And so I put together a proposal, a fairly extensive proposal, and I presented it at Concord to the president, the new president, and they approved it. And so one of the things that I'm supposed to do this year, this last year between now and next June 30th, is hustle that proposal to foundations and people like Jim Justice, who I don't know, but hopefully I will, and try to find funding. That's what I'm trying to do this year, is find funding. My major purpose is to transition everything we've done into that, so that even though funding for this grant will end next June, the process will continue to go on and you will continue to play an integral part in it. And so a lot of it is going to be contingent on the success of finding funding. I've already got some good, I talked to some folks in the West Virginia AFL CIO, and they're willing to kick in as much as $20,000 a month. $20,000 a year to support a center like this. And I haven't really contacted them and sat down and negotiated the things yet, but that's just the feedback I got. We want to do something. And then I talked to a couple of other people that I know, and they said, when you're ready to launch this thing, give me a call. We want to be involved, that kind of thing. So everything is very positive so far because everybody seems to think it's something that might be needed. Now, what the money would do, what I'm looking at, is it doesn't cost that much to run the thing. I mean, obviously you have to pay people living expenses because it's a job, and people like Bob set up all the equipment and go out and do on the road interviews and stuff. You got to have some money for that. But what I'm hoping is that we can get enough money to create an endowment. And of course, interest. Everybody knows interest. The interest on endowments now has gone way down because of the issues with the stock market, Wall Street, real estate, and housing, and all that stuff. But you can still get, if you can still get 3% on some pretty good investments. Well, what I thought is if I could get enough money to set up an endowment that would generate $50,000 a year, which would allow the hiring of somebody to run this thing every year forever, because the endowment would keep generating 3% every year in interest. So that would mean that the center would have a director and a visibility and an existence forever. If we can get enough, well, at 3%, you got to have like $1.3 million or something. $1.3 million at 3% will generate about $50,000 a year. So that's kind of what I'm after. So, I'm looking at serious money. I don't know whether I'll be able to do it or not. But I've got this 1 year to try. So that's my assignment. I'm going to be trying to do that. But in the process, part of it is this radio, is going back. And so starting after the week after Labor Day, we're going to start doing a live two-hour-a-day live call-in interactive program based on the Constitution every day, 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. And I'm hoping that we'll be able to have, you know, as guest interviews, we'll be able to have people like John Kaminsky and et cetera. But we're going to do that. We're going to do it from here. And part of the outreach is that next summer there's going to be tens of thousands of Boy Scouts coming to this area, as everybody knows. And so the idea of citizenship education is part of the Boy Scout orientation, and we're located right here. And so my feeling is that if we can transition what we're doing and what you're doing into that, then ultimately what we can do is service Boy Scouts because of the interactive part. Even after they leave and go back wherever they came from, with the Internet, they can still connect to a radio program. They can do assignments. And so what Nick Rahal's office suggested to me was that if you can tie citizenship education to the merit badge process that the scouts go after, you're going to get the best scouts. The best ones will be the ones that will be pursuing merit badges and Eagle Scout status and all this other stuff. And so that's the basic connection, that it seems like, and all of this is just theory at this point. But so basically what I'm thinking about is transitioning what we've got and where we are into that. And that process and the fact that we have the grant this year means that instead of you being graduate students taking a course, you can now become a consultant in this process of developing citizenship modules that theoretically will be available to the Boy Scouts for merit badge considerations when they come in here. And that will connect them to us and you to them. And that's my plan. And to try to explain that in print, but that's what I've got here under item 2. And so the idea is that what I want us to do, and after we break, I'll get into the details of this. But what I'd like us to do is think about, while we're here this week, is putting together modules built around citizenship, targeted specifically to the merit badge. There, and I've identified 7. I've been reading all the stuff about the... There are 7 merit badge categories that seem to me to apply to the issue of citizenship on the one hand, and to what we're doing on the other, that connect us to it. And I've listed them. Page 15? Okay. 14 and 15. There are 7 areas. They're on page 15. Citizenship in the community, citizenship in the nation, citizenship in the world, business, cultures, cultural diversity pretty much, American, you know, the interaction of different cultures, the law, and journalism. Every one of those, in one way or another, connects with citizenship. And what I mean by that is there's a right and a wrong way to do it. And this is what I was thinking. You know, there are issues in business if all you have to do is look around. If you don't see ethical issues associated with what's going on in the business world now and the issues of ethics and morality, given what happened to the economy, to what happened to our economy, and the fact that nobody's gone to jail other than Madoff, you know, and many of the people that caused it have seen their bonuses increase, and all, I mean, you know, there are all sorts of ethical issues involved. Journalism, there's a whole issue of libel, and the whole issue of truth. And Bob Bliss told me a story last night about his dad. I'm not going to tell it because he might want to tell it. But it's an unbelievable thing that happened years ago with his dad, who headed up a journalism department at Drake University. Drake is in Des Moines, Iowa. And there was an issue there that was unbelievable. A couple of people on staff did something that was absolutely unbelievable. And basically, the student newspaper got a hold of it and published it. And the president and dean called in his dad, who was head of the journalism department, and told them, you've got to sack the editor of the student newspaper. And he said, I'm not going to do that. And they said, well, at minimum, you've got to have him print a retraction. And he said, is it true? Is it true? And they said, yes, it is. He said, that's all. This meeting's over. That's all there is to it. And so if Bob tells you that story, you didn't hear that before. But anyway, the whole issue of journalism and Zanger and free press, free speech, and all this other—I mean, you know, there's all sorts of issues there. The issue of cultures, the whole idea—we're going to be looking at it in terms of human rights and civil liberties this fall in the online class. The role of the court. One of the areas is integrating society. One of the areas is, you know, how do you deal with multiple cultures? Is it possible? If you bring multiple cultures together, do you end up with a blend of all of them? Or does one culture... Conkle from the director of the Bird Center here, the Beckley Center. And so I told her, I said, well, what we need to do is we need to start going out for breakfast in the morning to different McDonald's, because I need to pick out table of geezers that I'm going to join every morning and go there for coffee and talk politics and coal mining and dirty coal and all this other stuff. So she said, oh my God, if you end up becoming one of those McDonald's fixtures, you know. And so anyway, but actually with this it's a little bit more ambitious. I don't think I'm going to have time to do that. But anyway, that's what's in the second area. Here, and that's what the second item is about, is the creation of the center and the transition. And then I've got the, very briefly on page 3 here, our schedule today, Tuesday, nothing on Wednesday, and then we'll come back next Monday, and that'll be it. And then we've got some content which I want to touch on, basically some content material in terms of where we are and where we've been and all of that. Do you all have any, I want us to be able to go out and have a break and have a cup of coffee and a muffin or whatever. But do you all have any interaction, any questions, comments, suggestions, criticisms, whatever? I gingerly dodged when we were talking about the teachers, the numbers of teachers that we've lost, going into the whys and stuff. I mean, I've gotten emails from people as to why, but, I don't necessarily, I believe some of it, and I'm not sure about others, but it doesn't matter. It's a very, very difficult process, I know. We've asked an awful lot of you, and I know that. There's a couple of alternatives, and one of them is to not ask a lot of you, and I can't do that. And I don't know that you would want me to. Yet at the same time, I understand that people have responsibilities, and they have lives, and they have families, and they have jobs, and they have church groups that they belong to, and other responsibilities besides this. I know that, and this is very, but I can tell you, and this is an honest, I'm telling you, this is absolutely true. An official of the West Virginia Department of Education sat in my office this spring, right across here, before I left the Beckley Center here, sat in my office and told me that in conversation with a couple of the teachers in the group, now this was before, this was the whole group, I don't know who they were, And basically I said, you need to realize that our teachers are so busy they don't have time to read. And the reason you're losing your teachers is because you're asking them to read. That's exactly what that person said. And I said, if a teacher isn't reading, they have no business being in the classroom. Especially this stuff. But, you know, and I know that they're busy. I know it. But basically, the argument was, go on, you know, rent a bus and go on a field trip and have a cookout and give them credits. And I can't do that. I won't do that. I can't do that. I just can't. And somebody else may do that, but I can't. I personally think that that may be an awful lot of what's wrong. But, I can't prove that. I just think that, believe that. But the fact is, we're asking, and I know, like, on these assignments and stuff. I mean, I know that, I've got a bunch of papers here. I'm not going to make a big deal out of that here. I'll give you back papers, those that submitted. And I've tried to be as flexible as I can on the dates, but I had one person who withdrew from our program. I know him very well. And basically he said, I'm going to have to, and he said, is there any way that I can stay in the program and not do anything? That's exactly what he said. And I said, well, there are courses that carry grades and have 3 credits. Well, how am I supposed to determine how am I supposed to give you a grade if you don't do anything? And how am I in good conscience going to ask other people to do something when there's somebody sitting here that I told them they didn't have to do anything? And the answer was, well, then I'm just going to have to withdraw because my schedule's so busy I can't find time to do it. But, I mean, I appreciate it because I know the person. And I appreciated the honesty, but I couldn't. But that's kind of what would, and I know that. The only thing that I've tried to do is find ways to, you know, I mean, I want to overfeed you and stuff you and that kind of thing. But to try to make it as rewarding, because I appreciate, you can't know how much I appreciate what you do. And I read these papers. I've read the papers. And some of them are A's and some of them are B's and some of them, you know, they misinterpret the question and these kinds of things. And that's all part of the process. But in terms of, in terms of what they are and what's in them and what you do, and I know what else you do, I'm just in admiration. I just have nothing but admiration for everybody. And that includes many of the people that are left. Many of them did leave for reasons that I know that are tough. We lost one person from Mercer County that had a stroke. And, this guy is just one of the greatest guys I've ever met. I mean, I just can't imagine a classroom without him. You know, to me that was a big loss. And those things, these kinds of things happen. And we have, people, and God knows, you're right at the, many of you are right at the age where your parents are, you have parents that need attention and need care, and God, I know that. It's hard. So what we can do is the best we can do. And the only thing I can do is tell you that I absolutely will do everything that I can do. I want you to submit. I'm not looking for stuff that can go directly from me to the front page of the New York Times. I'm not necessarily insisting that. And I know that some people have different backgrounds. We teach different levels. Some people deal with this content all the time. Some of you never deal with it, with this content, because of the nature of who you teach or where you teach. And I know that. And so it's much more difficult for you than it is for other people. And I appreciate that. And nobody's going to fail. That's not the issue. The issue is you will be better for whatever you do. Every one of us will be better for the content we've been exposed to, the resource. It's not what we remember. It's the resources. It's where we need to go. and knowing where to go to get what we need to do a better job. And that's more than anything else what this is about. You can't remember. You know, you don't remember 85% of the stuff we learn in school we forget or something. You know, it's the sophistication and the resources and the skills that we develop, so we know where to go and what to do. And one more thing before we break. Margaret, I think Margaret has a card later or something that she's going to ask us to do. But Mary Boone had some serious surgery not too long ago. In fact, it was the day we were scheduled to do it the first time, July 9th, I think it was. And she had some pretty serious heart surgery. And she's recovering, but she's, you know, still recovering. And so she has been in touch with us, and she emailed some stuff, some resources, and she's done some research, and she wants you to have access to some of the resources. So Margaret's copying things from Mary that we want to share with you, resources and websites and this kind of stuff. And so she's still hanging in there. I love Mary. She's wonderful. And so I think Margaret has gotten a card or something that she wants everybody to sign and send it. Why don't we take, it's 10:15, why don't we take a break and have something to eat and snack on and drink, and then we'll come back and we'll do a little bit more content and a little bit less personal stuff. I don't know how many people we got, but God, I don't have a calculator, but we have 14 people in 7 teams. And 7 topics. What can I tell you? Do you think something special's happening here? Do you think there are forces governing this that we don't know about? Obviously, if anybody's uncomfortable with this, we can change it. But I don't know how to divide. I mean, I assume everybody knows who they're partnering with. Okay. Why don't you just jot down your name and the person you're working with, and give it to Keith. And then we'll divide up the topics. I don't know that there's a preference on topics. Keith said that one group had a preference on topics, but does anybody have strong preferences for topics? Well, why don't you just, if you have a preference for it, then why don't you tell us what it is, and then we'll give it to you. The law. All right. And you have a partner. All right. The law. All right. What I want to do is I just want to make sure that we know which team is working on which topic. I don't want to have... Congress can't do anything, get anything done either, so it doesn't...
Let's
do it this way. Everybody, give me. Has everyone given me their name? Yeah. Okay. And if we end up with an extra person, you know, if somebody ends up, we'll just stick them on one of the existing teams. Okay. So, I don't know who that might be, but we might have somebody come in late or something. I don't know. You know, I know who's here, but I'm not sure that everybody is here yet.
No, I don't think anybody else expressed an interest in journalism.
All right. So can you write down what each group is doing, Keith? Here's a pen. Here's a pen. I want you to write it so you can read it. Right? If I write it, you won't be able to read it. Well, the problem is we don't want...
Okay, okay. So we've got Brian O'Connell and Danny Warner. They're doing the law. Okay?
Yep.
Pam Jackson and Susan Ryan. The Gillums, or Gillum and Mrs. Mitchell, are doing
business.
Michelle, you and Emily are going to Citizenship and Nation, right?
Huh? Yeah.
I can read your handwriting.
Okay.
And you're not.
I can read those, yeah. Mine's getting worse, though. '101, U.S. history. Can you imagine the founding? A rebellion against George Washington is coming. Journalism.
Journalism.
Okay. And we should have two groups to, so there they are.
Citizenship in the world. You okay, Pam Pam said would be journalism. That would leave you citizenship in the world. That's anybody who's willing to trade.
Well, you can it's your creation. You can make it citizenship wherever you want. I mean, I'm going to give you some what they say the main issues are. But this is your DBQ. I mean, there's no official DBQ to measure yours against.
This one would fill in with foreign policy, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's basically the whole idea of world government and are the problems too big for the nations to handle? Do we need a world government to handle world problems and that kind of stuff? That as the nation developed, details would be added and changes would be added. My feeling is that as the nation has developed, the very definition of rights has to change. Otherwise, the Constitution would become outdated. In other words, I personally believe that the reason the Constitution has lasted as long as it has with as few changes as it has had, is because it is just vague enough to continue to work even as change occurs. But the results, I think, are that rights and liberties have to change as America changes. And I believe that they were sharp enough to know that. And so they didn't put down something that was in concrete and say, this is it, everybody has to live this way, nothing can forever change. I don't believe that. And, for example, nobody would, at the time of the founders, people wouldn't predict necessarily the extent of change that was going to be produced by the Industrial Revolution. The fact that the huge amounts of Americans that were farmers would migrate to the cities, and that there would be more people living in the cities and working in factories in industrialism, along comes the issue of workers' rights to organize, workers' rights to a job, workers' rights to safety in the workplace, workers' rights to a living wage, workers' rights to, you know, et cetera. And then you have the right of labor to organize. And government begins to recognize labor's right to organize, the right to join a union and all of those other things. The founders couldn't necessarily have conceived of this. But clearly, with huge percentage of the American population working in industry during the Industrial Revolution in the late 19th and throughout much of the 20th century, to me there's no question that it doesn't make sense to have an industrial society like this one and say the workers don't have any rights because it's not in the Constitution. And other things. So I think that rights change as the situations change, as the country changes. And I think that that's the strength of the Constitution. But that means that the Constitution is living in that it continually is updated, so to speak. Different generations make the changes that are most appropriate for it. Now we're dealing with technology. Madison said in Federalist Number 10 that the salvation for America, for the salvation of the Constitution, is that our system, because it's a Republican form of government, our system is susceptible to majority rule. The majority rules. But in Federalist Number 10 and other documents as well, he pointed out the key here is that the majority never can organize. Because if we get a situation where the majority makes the decision rather than the people who are most qualified to make decisions, he called it democracy, we call that socialism. That becomes what we mean by socialism. That government is, you know, under direct control of the people. The people are the ones that tell government what laws to pass, what how much taxes to charge, what our foreign policy ought to be. So what you have, if it's based on majority rule, then you have the least qualified, the least intelligent people basically making the decisions. And that doesn't make any sense. So Madison's position is that the majority faction is the biggest threat. And then he says, I don't want to get into all these details, but he talks in Federalist Number 10, the biggest cause of factions is the unequal distribution of property, the differences between rich and poor. And so if you take what he said about majority faction and you put it in the context of rich versus poor, what he's talking about, if the poor ever organize because they are majority and take political power, we're dead. That's basically what you have to conclude from Madison. That's what I conclude. This is really scary. And Madison never envisioned the internet. He never envisioned iPhones and iPads. And we're witnessing right now revolutions happening in the Middle East, in Libya, in Cairo, in all through the Middle East that are being run on cell phones. The technology is making it possible for the majority to organize and to unite that Madison never envisioned. And he predicted this nation could not prevail. could not survive that. And that scares me to death. So my feeling is that, you know, that we are experiencing and facing things that the founders never could have envisioned. And so, therefore, the Constitution has to be able to adjust and deal with these things. And it needs to be, you know, it needs to be updated. I believe that. So I think the reason I put in this whole process the idea of human rights and civil liberties is because there's two issues here. It seems to me what the difference between rights and liberties, you know, you have the idea that people, because they are people, ought to have certain rights. They ought to be entitled to certain things. They ought to be free. What does that? What does freedom mean? Is it the right to do whatever you want? Or is it the right to do, you know, and we tried, the Supreme Court tried to work this out, but the idea that John Stuart Mill made the argument that your freedom to swing your, no, it was Oliver Holmes, I think, made the, in a Supreme Court decision, made the case that your freedom to swing your fist ends where my nose begins. You know, and
Thank you. Thank you.
pay for it. But for the first 3 years, I paid for it. These schools, Jefferson said, are to be under a visitor who is annually to choose the boy of best genius in the school. Notice, not girls. Girls don't get educated here. The visitor selects the boy of